Chapter 99. Motion towards a gentleman who had been previously showing his teeth by the fireplace, and gave us to understand that it was Mr. Minson, of whom he had spoken. It required no great penetration on our part to discover at once that Mr. Minson was in every respect a very friendly young gentleman. "I am delighted," said Minson, hastily advancing, and pressing our hand warmly between both of his. "I am delighted, I am sure, to make your acquaintance here," he smiled, "very much delighted indeed." Here he exhibited a little emotion. "I assure you that I have looked forward to it anxiously for a very long time." Here he released our hands, and rubbing his own, observed that the day was severe, but that he was delighted to perceive from our appearance that it agreed with us wonderfully, and then went on to observe that, notwithstanding the coldness of the weather, he had that morning seen in the paper an exceedingly curious paragraph, to the effect that there was now in the garden of Mr. Wilkins of Chichester a pumpkin, measuring 4 feet in height and 11 feet 7 inches in circumference, which he looked upon as a very extraordinary piece of intelligence. We ventured to remark that we had a dim recollection of having once or twice before observed a similar paragraph in the public prints, upon which Mr. Minson took us confidentially by the button, and said, "Exactly, exactly, to be sure, we were very right," and he wondered what the editors meant by putting in such things. Who the deuce, he should like to know, did they suppose cared about them? That struck him as being the best of it. The lady of the house appeared shortly afterwards, and Mr. Minson's friendliness, as will readily be supposed, suffered no diminution in consequence. He exerted much strength and skill in wheeling a large easy chair up to the fire, and the lady being seated in it, carefully closed the door, stirred the fire, and looked to the windows to see that they admitted no air. Having satisfied himself upon all these points, he expressed himself quite easy in his mind, and begged to know how she found herself today. Upon the lady's replying very well, Mr. Minson, who it appeared was a medical gentleman, offered some general remarks upon the nature and treatment of colds in the head, which occupied us agreeably until dinner time. During the meal, he devoted himself to complimenting everybody, not forgetting himself, so that we were an uncommonly agreeable quartet. "I'll tell you what, Capper," said Mr. Minson to our host, as he closed the room door after the lady had retired, "you have very great reason to be fond of your wife. Sweet woman, Mrs. Capper, sir. Nay, Minson, I beg," interposed the host, as we were about to reply that Mrs. Capper unquestionably was particularly sweet. "Pray, Minson, don't." "Why not?" exclaimed Mr. Minson, "why not? Why should you feel any delicacy before your old friend, our old friend, if I may be allowed to call you so, sir? Why should you, I ask?" We of course wished to know why he should also, upon which our friend admitted that Mrs. Capper was a very sweet woman, at which admission Mr. Minson cried bravo, and begged to propose Mrs. Capper with heartfelt enthusiasm, whereupon our host said, "Thank you, Minson," with deep feeling, and gave us, in a low voice, to understand that Minson had saved Mrs. Capper's cousin's life no less than 14 times in a year and a half, which he considered no common circumstance, and opinion to which we most cordially subscribed. Now that we three were left to entertain ourselves with conversation, Mr. Minson's extreme friendliness became every moment more apparent. He was so amazingly friendly, indeed, that it was impossible to talk about anything in which he had not the chief concern. we happened to allude to some affairs in which our friend and we had been mutually engaged nearly 14 years before, when Mr. Minson was all at once reminded of a joke which our friend had made on that day 4 years, which he positively must insist upon telling, and which he did tell accordingly, with many pleasant recollections of what he said, and what Mrs. Capper said, and how he well remembered that they had been to the play with orders on the very night previous, and had seen Romeo and Juliet, and the pantomime, and how Mrs. Capper being faint had been led into the lobby, where she smiled, said it was nothing after all, and went back again, with many other interesting and absorbing particulars. After which the friendly young gentleman went on to assure us that our friend had experienced a marvelously prophetic opinion of that same pantomime, which was of such an admirable kind, that two morning papers took the same view next day. To this our friend replied, with a little triumph, that in that instance he had some reason to think he had been correct, which gave the friendly young gentleman occasion to believe that our friend was always correct. And so we went on, until our friend, filling a bumper, said he must drink one glass to his dear friend Minson, than whom he would say no man saved the lives of his acquaintances more, or had a more friendly heart. Finally, our friend having emptied his glass, said, God bless you, Minson, apostrophe and Mr. Minson, and he shook hands across the table with much affection and earnestness. But great as the friendly young gentleman is, in a limited scene like this, he plays the same part on a larger scale with Incris Decklet. Mr. Minson is invited to an evening party with his dear friends the Martins, where he meets his dear friends the Cappers, and his dear friends the Watsons, and a hundred other dear friends too numerous to mention. He is as much at home with the Martins as with the Cappers. But how exquisitely he balances his attentions, and divides them among his dear friends. If he flirts with one of the Miss Watsons, he has one little Martin on the sofa pulling his hair, and the other little Martin on the carpet writing on his foot. He carries Mrs. Watson down to supper on one arm, and Miss Martin on the other, and takes wine so judiciously, and in such exact order, that it is impossible for the most punctilious old lady to consider herself neglected. If any young lady, being prevailed upon to sing, become nervous afterwards, Mr. Minson leads her tenderly into the next room, and restores her with port wine, which she must take medicinally. If any gentleman be standing by the piano during the progress of the ballad, Mr. Minson seizes him by the arm at one point of the melody, and softly beating time the while with his head, expresses in dumb show his intense perception of the delicacy of the passage. If anybody's self-love is to be flattered, Mr. Minson is at hand. If anybody's overweening vanity is to be pampered, Mr. Minson will surfeit it. What wonder that people of all stations and ages recognize Mr. Minson's friendliness, that he is universally allowed to be handsome as amiable, that mothers think him an oracle, daughters a dear, brothers a beau, and fathers a wonder. And who would not have the reputation of the very friendly young gentleman? The military young gentleman, we are rather at a loss to imagine how it has come to pass that military young gentlemen have obtained so much favor in the eyes of the young ladies of this kingdom. We cannot think so lightly of them as to suppose that the mere circumstance of a man's wearing a red coat ensures him a ready passport to their regard. And even if this were the case, it would be no satisfactory explanation of the circumstance, because, although the analogy may in some degree hold good in the case of male coachmen and guards, still general postmen wear red coats, and they are not to our knowledge better received than other men, nor are firemen either, who wear or used to wear, not only red coats, but very resplendent and massive badges besides much larger than epaulettes. Neither do the twopenny post office boys, if the result of our inquiries be correct, find any peculiar favor in women's eyes, although they wear very bright red jackets, and have the additional advantage of constantly appearing in public on horseback, which last circumstance may be naturally supposed to be greatly in their favor. We have sometimes thought that this phenomenon may take its rise in the conventional behavior of captains and colonels, and other gentlemen in red coats on the stage, where they are invariably represented as fine swaggering fellows, talking of nothing but charming girls, their king and country, their honor, and their debts, and crowing over the inferior classes of the community, whom they occasionally treat with a little gentlemanly swindling, no less to the improvement and pleasure of the audience, than to the satisfaction and approval of the choice spirits who consort with them. But we will not devote these pages to our speculations upon the subject, inasmuch as our business at the present moment is not so much with the young ladies who are bewitched by Her Majesty's livery, as with the young gentlemen whose heads are turned by it. For heads we had written brains, apostrophe, but upon consideration, we think the former the more appropriate word of the two. These young gentlemen may be divided into two classes: young gentlemen who are actually in the army, and young gentlemen who, having an intense and enthusiastic admiration for all things appertaining to a military life, are compelled by adverse fortune or adverse relations to wear out their existence in some ignoble counting house. We will take this latter description of military young gentlemen first. The whole heart and soul of the military young gentleman are concentrated in his favorite topic. There is nothing that he is so learned upon as uniforms. He will tell you, without faltering for an instant, what the habiliments of any one regiment are turned up with, what regiment wears stripes down the outside and inside of the leg, and how many buttons the 10th had on their coats. He knows to a fraction how many yards and odd inches of gold lace it takes to make an ensign in the Guards, is deeply read in the comparative merits of different bands, and the aproling of trumpeters, and is very luminous indeed in descanting upon crack regiments, apostrophe, and the crack gentlemen who compose them, of whose mightiness and grandeur he is never tired of telling. We were suggesting to a military young gentleman only the other day, after he had related to us several dazzling instances of the profusion of half a dozen honorable ensign somebodies or nobodies in the articles of kid gloves and polished boots, that possibly cracked regiments would be an improvement upon crack, apostrophe, as being a more expressive and appropriate designation, when he suddenly interrupted us by pulling out his watch, and observing that he must hurry off to the park in a cab, or he would be too late to hear the band play. Not wishing to interfere with so important an engagement, and being in fact already slightly overwhelmed by the anecdotes of the honorable ensigns aforementioned, we made no attempt to detain the military young gentleman, but parted company with ready goodwill. Some 3 or 4 hours afterwards, we chanced to be walking down Whitehall, on the Admiralty side of the way, when, as we drew near to one of the little stone places in which a couple of horse soldiers mount guard in the daytime, we were attracted by the motionless appearance and eager gaze of a young gentleman, who was devouring both man and horse with his eyes, so eagerly, that he seemed deaf and blind to all that was passing around him. We were not much surprised at the discovery that it was our friend, the military young gentleman, but we were a little astonished when we returned from a walk to South Lambeth to find him still there, looking on with the same intensity as before. As it was a very windy day, we felt bound to awaken the young gentleman from his reverie, when he inquired of us with great enthusiasm whether that was not a glorious spectacle, apostrophe, and proceeded to give us a detailed account of the weight of every article of the spectacle's trappings, from the man's gloves to the horse's shoes. We have made it a practice since to take the horse guards in our daily walk, and we find it is the custom of military young gentlemen to plant themselves opposite the sentries, and contemplate them at leisure, in periods varying from 15 minutes to 50, and averaging 25. We were much struck a day or two since by the behavior of a very promising young butcher who, evincing an interest in the service, which cannot be too strongly commanded or encouraged, after a prolonged inspection of the sentry, proceeded to handle his boots with great curiosity, and as much composure and indifference, as if the man were waxwork. But the really military young gentleman is waiting all this time, and at the very moment that an apology rises to our lips, he emerges from the barrack gate he is quartered in a garrison town, and takes the way towards the high street. He wears his undress uniform, which somewhat mars the glory of his outward man. But still, how great, how grand, he is! What a happy mixture of ease and ferocity in his gait and carriage, and how lightly he carries that dreadful sword under his arm, making no more ado about it than if it were a silk umbrella. The lion is sleeping. Only think if an enemy were in sight, how soon he'd whip it out of the scabbard, and what a terrible fellow he would be. But he walks on, thinking of nothing less than blood and slaughter. And now he comes in sight of three other military young gentlemen, arm in arm, who are bearing down towards him, clanking their iron heels on the pavement, and clashing their swords with a noise which should cause all peaceful men to quail at heart. They stop to talk. See how the flaxen-haired young gentleman with the weak legs, he who has his pocket handkerchief thrust into the breast of his coat, glares upon the faint-hearted civilians who linger to look upon his glory. How the next young gentleman elevates his head in the air, and majestically places his arms akimbo, while the third stands with his legs very wide apart, and clasps his hands behind him. Well may we inquire, not in familiar jest, but in respectful earnest, if you call it nothing. Oh, if some encroaching foreign power, the Emperor of Russia, for instance, or any of those deep fellows, could only see those military young gentlemen as they move on together towards the billiard room over the way, wouldn't he tremble a little? And then, at the theater at night, when the performances are by command of Colonel Fitz Swordist and the officers of the garrison, what a splendid sight it is! How sternly the defenders of their country look round the house, as if in mute assurance to the audience that they may make themselves comfortable regarding any foreign invasion. For they, the military young gentlemen, are keeping a sharp lookout, and are ready for anything. And what a contrast between them, and that stage box full of gray-headed officers with tokens of many battles about them, who have nothing at all in common with the military young gentlemen, and who but for an old-fashioned kind of manly dignity in their looks and bearing might be common hard-working soldiers for anything they take the pains to announce to the contrary. Ah! Here is a family just come in to recognize the flaxen-headed young gentleman. And the flaxen-headed young gentleman recognizes them too, only he doesn't care to show it just now. Very well done indeed. He talks louder to the little group of military young gentlemen who are standing by him, and coughs to induce some ladies in the next box, but one to look round, in order that their faces may undergo the same ordeal of criticism to which they have subjected, in not a wholly inaudible tone, the majority of the female portion of the audience. Oh! A gentleman in the same box looks round, as if he were disposed to resent this as an impertinence, and the flaxen-headed young gentleman sees his friends at once, and hurries away to them with the most charming cordiality. Three young ladies, one young man, and the mama of the party receive the military young gentleman with great warmth and politeness, and in 5 minutes afterwards the military young gentleman, stimulated by the mama, introduces the two other military young gentlemen with whom he was walking in the morning, who take their seats behind the young ladies and commence conversation. Whereat the mama bestows a triumphant bow upon the rival mama, who has not succeeded in decoying any military young gentleman, and prepares to consider her visitors from that moment three of the most elegant and superior young gentlemen in the whole world. The political young gentleman, once upon a time not in the days when pigs drank wine, but in a more recent period of our history it was customary to banish politics when ladies were present. If this usage still prevailed. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.